A key part of putting the Paris Agreement into effect is finance, mobilizing the cash that developing countries need to build and scale up green infrastructure. The agreement doesn't include a firm commitment from rich countries to finance these projects. But Lord Nicholas Stern of the London School of Economics, who quantified the cost of global warming in the authoritative 2006 Stern Report, says that this deal does open a new pathway for investment and prosperity.
I think it's a very good deal. It says that we have to get not only below 2 degrees, but do our best to get as close to 1.5 degrees centigrade as we can. At 2 degrees, you start to be on the edge of real tipping points and lots of irreversible effects. So to say that we'll do our best to stay well below 2 degrees is very important. We didn't know that we'd get that ambition. We didn't know that 1.5 would be mentioned. Second thing that's in there that we couldn't have been sure of was a commitment to review after 5 years, together with a recognition that the current intentions for 2030 are way too high. If you add up all the intentions, you get to levels of emissions about 10% higher than now, whereas for a 2-degree path, we really ought to be in 2030, something like 20% lower. So that ramping up of ambition is right there in the agreement. And on finance, there's a commitment of rich countries to increase their support. Those are just three ways in which I think this is a really good agreement. And I hope that the historians will see this as a historic turning point.
To what extent does this agreement help raise the living standards of the poorest among us?
This is about getting sustainable energy to the more than 1 billion people in the world who don't have access to electricity. For example, small solar photovoltaic panels with batteries you can charge up mean that people can help their kids study in the evening by some kind of light, which is not kerosene, which is, of course, polluting inside the house. It helps people cook in ways which don't poison their lungs. Just in so many ways, in health and education, empowering people to look after their own source of energy. This is a story of fostering the ambitions of people, enabling them to change their lives for themselves.
Now, in this agreement, we're still talking about $100 billion a year to help the least developed countries. That's a number that was put down some 6 years ago when Copenhagen fell apart. How do you see this agreement as progress along those lines with the funding to the least developed countries?
I remember that very well, Steve, because I negotiated that $100 billion working together with Prime Minister Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia, who sadly died 3 years ago, and Mike Froman, who was then working with Hillary Clinton negotiating for the United States. So I remember it very well. And it's important, but that's just a small part of the story. The bigger part of the story is enabling people to invest for themselves. And the $100 billion by itself doesn't do that, but what it can help do is to create circumstances where cheap finance from a wide variety of sources becomes available. We're now seeing a much bigger story in the trillions of people seeing where the world is going and putting their money to follow that.
The president of Ethiopia pointed out to me that the interest rates for domestic development there are much higher than the West. If you have to pay 16% for money, the capital that you can deploy making payments on that loan is much smaller than what you could do with the 3, 4, 5%. How can we bridge the interest rate gap to help development in the least developed countries?
Steve, that's an absolutely critical point. If you're paying 10% real, say, and if you compare that with paying 3% real, you're cutting it by more than a factor of 3. Now, a lot of the things we're talking about are activities where capital cost is high in relation to the output. Indeed, that's the point of renewables. You buy your solar PV panel, and then the sun shines, and you don't pay for the sunshine. So that's a sense in which the capital's much bigger part of your cost. So the cost of capital is extremely important. We can see that governments around the world can borrow, a lot of them, at close to zero, real. So how do you do it? How do you close that gap?
Indeed, how do you do it?
Well, a lot of these things are about risk. So what you try to do, for example, is get the multilateral development banks, World Bank, Asia Development Bank, you get them involved in these kinds of deals where they can give guarantees or they can take the first loss. And the cost of capital goes right down, because people have confidence in that entity. And they also actually reduce the risk itself, because if some of that risk is about, you know, people not behaving very well, then that's less likely to happen if those banks are involved. I think that this is the area where we're going to start to see the big money flow, because we can see this set of opportunities, and that's the way in which the cost of capital is going to come down.
So if you were in charge of everything, what's your first move? What's the most important next step in terms of finance, dealing with the climate crisis?
I would say two important things. One is to countries around the world now to recognize that this is the sense of direction. So they should be following policies which establish a price for carbon, invest in innovation, and then build the financial systems that allow that investment demand to be financed at reasonably low cost. And through their big financial institutions that manage private money, together with the good policies in government, we should be in for an era where those tremendous low carbon investment opportunities become investment demand, which are financed by a reinvigorated financial system.
Lord Stern is with the London School of Economics. Thank you so much, Nick, for taking time with us today.
It's a pleasure talking to you, Steve.